This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In a moment, gentrification, how an influx of newcomers and redevelopment is changing the character of longtime neighborhoods in Charlotte's inner core. First, though, a ruling at the federal level on North Carolina's voter ID law. Yesterday, U.S. District Judge Thomas Schroeder dismissed all claims in the challenge to the state's sweeping 2013 election law overhaul. Judge Schroeder's ruling runs 487 pages, but Catawba College Provost and Political Science Professor Dr. Michael Bitzer settled in last night for some light reading and joins us now to help us understand what this ruling means for the state, for other election law changes around the country, and for the November election. Good morning, Dr. Bitzer. I'm sure you didn't sleep last night. You just read all night long. Welcome.
Oh, it's morning already?
Yes,
wow.
It is. Okay. Somewhere in the country it is. Yeah. Judge Schroeder was the George W. Bush appointee, and these voter law changes were enacted by a Republican legislature. So did this decision come as a surprise to anyone?
I don't think it did. He made an earlier ruling in 2014 when the plaintiffs were seeking to at least block some of the actions of this election law overhaul. He ruled against them. So I think this is just par for the course. Certainly partisanship played a role in terms of the adoption of these laws, but also partisanship can be viewed in terms of the review by the judiciary of these laws across the country.
So remind us about these laws, because they went into effect, and then some of them were delayed because of primaries, et cetera. So what exactly do the 2013 voter law changes mean to voters? What do they do or not do?
Well, basically, we will have the full effect come this November in the general election. The most prominent one is the requirement for presenting some form of identification by the voter in order to cast a ballot. Now, subsequently, from when they passed this original law, the legislature and the governor signed an amendment to it that basically allows for reasonable impediments by the voter to the requirements of voter ID. It also decreased early voting by days, but not necessarily hours. The issue of same-day registration was done away with, along with out-of-precinct voting. And when the court ruled last night, they basically found no discriminatory impact of any of those aspects of the election law overhaul.
Now, to reach this decision, Judge Schroeder conducted a two-part trial, one last July and another this past January. But this is not the only battle over voter ID laws being waged across the country, is it? And if not, is this ruling likely to affect in any way other fights over voter ID?
Well, we've certainly seen it across the country. I think it's well over 30 states have enacted some form of voter identification laws, and they range in from strict, very strict voter laws to kind of not strict, flexible laws. I think North Carolina is not considered necessarily one of the most strict versions simply because of the reasonable impediment requirement. But the U.S. Supreme Court, who's kind of the final arbiter of all of these controversies, ruled on Indiana's voter ID and said that even though there may not necessarily be documented cases of voter fraud, that is a legitimate state interest to protect the electoral process. So I think if this case goes to appeal, which likely it will, it'll go to the Fourth Circuit in Richmond, may find its way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, but they've also ruled on a state like South Carolina that has a very comparable kind of voter ID law with reasonable impediment qualifications. They upheld that particular law as well. So my suspicion is we'll see an upholding of this judge's decision at the Fourth Circuit and most likely at the U.S. Supreme Court as
Judge,
well.
Judge Schroeder did keep in place same-day registration and out-of-precinct voting for the June 8th primaries. Why did he do that? And after June 8th, do those things go away?
The answer is yes, he did allow it for the June election simply because of the closeness at this time. The U.S. Supreme Court has held that any kind of policy changes related to electioneering policies should not be done as close as this is to a potential election, but after June, all of those go away.
Those who are opposed to these laws here and around the country have said that the idea in a free society should be an attempt to make voting as easy as possible and not put impediments in the way of voters trying to get to the polls to cast their votes. In his ruling, Judge Schroeder said that the 2014 data merely confirm what the remaining data suggest, that minorities enjoy, these are his words, that minorities enjoy equal and constitutionally compliant opportunity to participate in the electoral process. And he goes on to say that government should endeavor to make voting as easy as practicable, but the fact that voting can almost always be made easier does not render a state's failure to do so or a state's repeal of a convenience unlawful or unconstitutional. Now, I'm not a lawyer, but that seems to give wide latitude to states to decide what they will and will not do to make voting accessible. Would that be accurate?
That's very accurate, and that's the history of the country. That's part of our federal system. While the U.S. federal Constitution lays basic ground rules for voting, such as the 14th Amendment, the 15th Amendment, allowing women to vote, allowing those over the age of 18 to vote, it is up to the states who administer elections to really kind of set their own thresholds and their own levels of convenience or inconvenience, as long as it's not discriminatory against a protected class such as African Americans, Latinos, and others.
So how might this impact this November's elections?
I think politically this is a good win for Republicans. They've certainly needed one after the congressional maps were struck down and the controversy over HB 2. This is a good solid win for Republicans. Democrats will use this to energize their base to say we need to do even more grassroots organization and mobilization. So, you know, both sides are going to come out of this with potential victories, but certainly it is a core check for the Republican Party here in North Carolina.
Dr. Michael Bitzer, provost at Catawba College and professor of political science and the principal writer, maybe the only writer on our political blog here at WFAE. Thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Change is coming quickly to Charlotte's urban core. Areas that were once written off have become hot properties. Older, mostly residential neighborhoods close to downtown are now experiencing revitalization. New people are moving in. New houses are going up. Home values are increasing. All good news until you consider how this new development is changing the character of these longstanding neighborhoods and how it's impacting longtime residents. There's a name for this: gentrification. But is there a solution? We look at that for the rest of the hour with Pam Kelly, a reporter for the Charlotte Observer, who recently wrote about this in her story, White People in Biddleville, The Story of a Changing Neighborhood. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Also with us is Pamela Weidman, who's becoming so a frequent guest on this program, so she's almost a co-host. Pamela Weidman is Deputy Director of Neighborhoods and Business Services for the City of Charlotte. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And Mary Newsom is here, Associate Director for Urban and Regional Affairs at UNC Charlotte's Urban Institute. Welcome back again.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Gentrification is happening in a lot of close-in neighborhoods. Many have been the traditionally African-American neighborhoods like Cherry, Villa Heights, Wesley Heights, to name a few. Why did you choose, Pam, to write about Biddleville?
Mostly because of its, a couple reasons. One, its history. Biddleville is the site of Johnson C. Smith. It's the epicenter of the civil rights movement in Charlotte. Incredible history there. And some people in Biddleville who actually lived through the civil rights movement and were very important people in Charlotte, including Dorothy Count Scoggins. The other thing was just where it was in the process. You could see the new buildings. You could see the $500,000 houses beside these smaller, older houses. And yet you had the old and the new still there together.
Is there a great concern in that neighborhood by the longtime residents of what's happening around them?
It's really interesting. Most of them are okay with it. The ones who are homeowners stand to gain. Their properties will appreciate, have appreciated. And they have been, I think, overall very welcoming. Mm-hmm. I think there is concern among people who are maybe renters who are really poor, but they're not the ones that come to the neighborhood association meetings, so it's harder to get their opinion. I actually tried to talk to some on the street, and there was much more, I could feel much more concern and maybe even hostility.
Okay. Gentrification, we're going to throw that word around a lot. Is there a definition, a firm definition for gentrification? You're shaking your head no.
That's one of my little wording pet peeves, because I think it means a lot of different – it means different things to different people. It's kind of like the word urban. You know, urban can mean clothing styles. It can mean, you know, the heart of New York. It can mean the – anyway. Right. And gentrification, sometimes people use it to mean white people moving into black neighborhoods. Sometimes people use it to mean rich people moving into poor neighborhoods. Sometimes people just use it to mean the neighborhood's changing. It's just got a different meaning in everybody's mind. So I think it's important to talk about, are we talking about displacement? Are we talking about changing demographics?
Well, here's the city's definition. A Charlotte City Council report calls gentrification a process by which higher-income households displace lower-income households, changing the essential character and flavor of that neighborhood. You're with the city. What does that mean? What is the flavor of a neighborhood, Pamela?
Generally, what I think it means in terms of flavor of the neighborhood, it's back to the character of the neighborhood. The buildings, the housing stock seems to change. And also the people change. As you said earlier, this occurs most often in African American neighborhoods. And so when that flavor starts to change as people, you start to see a term that's known as hipsters, younger people, right. Different style housing. So people and the character of the neighborhood changes.
But you've been here long enough, Mary, to remember what Dilworth was like prior to what it's like today. And in the 80s and further back, these were mill houses. And by the 80s, they had fallen into disrepair, and poorer people, lower-income people, were living there. And the whole South End area was kind of sketchy back then. Does that fall into gentrification? What has happened since then? Because it wasn't pushing African-Americans out. It was essentially people wanting to live closer in and...
Yeah, I think it would be hard to say that what happened in Dilworth was gentrification by most accepted uses of the term, because Dilworth started out as an affluent, middle-class white neighborhood, affluent or not, middle-class. And then it became a less affluent white neighborhood. Some of the houses in Dilworth were targeted for urban renewal, mm-hmm. but I think a lot of them were not urban renewed, thank goodness. So then what happened was the hipsters of the day, the hippies, moved in to Dilworth and decided great houses, we can afford them, let's live here. Mm-hmm. And they grew old and got richer. And so Dilworth transitioned from middle-income white to less-income white to more upper-income white.
Is that what's happening today? In areas that are being so-called gentrified?
Well, I think it depends on the neighborhood. One of the interesting things that I've learned is you've got a lot of neighborhoods that are like Wesley Heights and Seaversville started out as all white. Then urban renewal came. Black folks needed houses. They transitioned to almost all black. Now they're transitioning again to mixed neighborhood.
We have to take a break. We'll continue this conversation for the rest of the hour and look at more of what's happening around town with gentrification. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and TFM Carolina's Sovereign Oaks, opening a new neighborhood on Saturday featuring home sites shaded by forest with access to a greenhouse, the apiary, and Bull Creek, sovereignoaks.com. And Bojangles, featuring the roasted chicken bites combo, marinated boneless chicken made from scratch biscuit, a fixin' and drink, available all day at area Bojangles. Every city has couples who struggle with infertility issues, but Charlotte has been characterized as a small city with big city infertility treatment. We've become a hub of knowledge in the field of infertility research, and nearly 4,000 people a year here seek out treatment. We're going to meet some of the people on the front lines of that research working to help people find answers to what has come to be recognized as a disease. That's tomorrow on this program at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, President Obama has approved the deployment of an additional 250 special operations forces in Syria to advise and assist in the fight against ISIS, the status of the conflict, and new efforts to undermine the Islamic State's power in the region and its influence beyond.
The Diane Rehm Show from 10 to noon following Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about gentrification. I almost said urban renewal, which we may get into in a second. Gentrification with Pam Kelly, a reporter for the Charlotte Observer, who wrote an extensive article about gentrification happening in Biddleville, which is the home of Johnson C. Smith University on the west side. Pamela Weidman is deputy director of the Neighborhood and Business Services for the City of Charlotte, and Mary Newsom is associate director of the Urban and Regional Affairs area of UNC Charlotte's Urban Institute. We just ended up talking, Mary, about Dilworth. When you look at Dilworth today, knowing what we know about what it used to be, it's hard to argue that it's not an improvement.
It depends. If you're looking for an affordable house in a close-in neighborhood, you probably can't afford Dilworth unless you're above a certain income level.
Well, that was my next question, which is, who is hurt? There are people hurt by gentrification. Who is hurt by it?
I think who is hurt is people, maybe people who want to live in that school district and they can't afford it. But then you have a ripple effect. So those folks move into a fringier area. And that neighborhood begins to, quote-unquote, improve. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times that's a good thing. I mean, it can lower crime rates when people with more solid incomes move into an area. But then you have the problem of displacement. Who gets kicked out because they can't afford it?
Where's the tipping point? Because except for renters, if you're a property owner and people are building and you own a house that's been there for 50, 60, 70 years and it's worth $100,000 and people come in and buy the house next door that's worth $100,000 and take it down and build a $600,000, $700,000, $800,000 house on it, how are you hurt?
Your property taxes go up by and large. Yes, where's the tipping point? I think that's one of those questions that nobody really knows. And maybe Pamela with the city, she's shaking her head. Depends on what you're looking at as tipping. You know, if your property taxes, then it's what can you afford on the income that you have if you're a retiree, for instance.
Right. I want to talk more about that in a minute or two. Julie on Facebook writes, could you explain the difference in gentrification versus revitalization? We moved into a neighborhood with houses built in the early 50s and were mostly renovated in the 70s and are still owned by the original owners and builders. Now that they are aging, 80 plus, and selling, our home value is 3 times what we paid in 2012 due to houses being purchased, renovated, and either rented or flipped. Would this be revitalizing an older neighborhood, or would it be gentrification?
I think it would be a little bit of both, Mike. So I was a part of a seminar earlier this week, and the speaker talked. There's an interesting way to look at. We think of revitalization in terms of revitalizing, making everything new, but often neighborhoods are already vital. Right. So it's just making them even more vital rather than the term that we often use in terms of revitalization. So it's adding the vitality to those neighborhoods that are already vital. Gentrification, again, in my mind, it's not bad. It's neighborhood change. It only is bad, in my mind, when people are involuntarily displaced. Many people choose to cash in, if you will, when those property taxes go up. That's their choice. It's bad when people are displaced after they've lived in a neighborhood for all of their lives. They've set up their support systems there, and so they are forced out. Mm-hmm. I think that you talked about the tipping point earlier. As Mary said, no city, to my knowledge, has really struck an accurate balance, and that's the challenge. How do you have enough affordable in there for various reasons, for the renters, for people to age in place when they no longer want to live in that single family home? And how do you have enough of the new in there?
There are statistics that seem to indicate that while the poorest residents in gentrifying neighborhoods are not any more likely than others to leave, when they do leave, they generally find themselves having to move to worse neighborhoods. Why?
Well, I think one of the – I mean, affordable housing, quote, unquote, is another one of those squishy terms. But when you're very, very low-income people, the housing that's available to you, unless you're one of the lucky small minority to get into subsidized housing, the what's available to you is really crappy housing. And when crappy housing gets fixed up, it isn't affordable anymore. So the poorest of the poor – you know, the landlord says, hey, I can get $100 more a month, so raises the rent. The poorest of the poor have to leave or they get evicted, so they've got to go to – they got to find other crappy housing, yeah, which is probably a bad neighborhood.
Yeah. I want to bring Christopher Dennis into the program because he's nodding over here as you're talking. He knows a lot about what we've been discussing because he's the president – has been the president of the Lockwood neighborhood for 12 years. Lockwood is along North Tryon and North Graham near NoDa. He also owns eFix Housing Solutions, a community-focused redevelopment company, and is founder of Community Dream Builders, which is a 501c3 with a mission of providing funding low-income neighborhoods. And you call that giving these neighborhoods access to opportunities to thrive. Is that access derived through access to capital, to money?
No, it's more – the Community Dream Builders' focus is more to provide programs and opportunities that go into low-income communities and allow those communities to kind of, in a sense, organically start to work within themselves. We started a Leave It Behind, which was an at-risk program. So in looking at the Lockwood community in the beginning stages, we know when we look at areas that are challenged, there's always an issue around youth in the community. So what Community Dream Builders did was try and focus on how do we address some of these youths, give them opportunities, and show them there's outreach and other programs that are willing to work with them. And now we're starting to move into other programs, which we're looking at for housing.
As we were talking with Mary about the people who are being moved out of neighborhoods that are being gentrified, generally having to go to someplace lesser than what they're leaving behind because that's all they can afford, you were nodding in recognition of that. How often does that happen?
It is a major issue because, as we know, gentrification isn't something new. It's been happening for many years, and it's affected a lot of communities, and we've got to figure out how to get it right. And one of the things around it is affordable housing and having creative ways to look at affordable housing, because what happens is, as you stated, that, you know, these areas that are going through these challenges and these changes, as people come in and they rent houses or renovate them, the price value goes up to the point where it is not the rent is higher than the rent for a normal person trying to stay in that area. So they do get pushed out, and it's more of the lending on the backside of it as well.
He mentioned having to get this right. Does the city, Pamela, have any controls in place that would preserve the character of older neighborhoods or the availability of affordable housing in these neighborhoods as the character of those neighborhoods begins to change?
We do, Mike. One of the city's premier programs is called the Safe Home Program, and that's a program where we go in and we preserve the existing housing stock by doing rehabs. It allows primarily for seniors to age in place. It can assist with rehabbing items in a home that homeowners might not otherwise be able to afford.
So how does that work? I own my home. I'm retired. I'm 75, 80 years old. I need a new stove. I need a new refrigerator. Maybe my bathroom floor is rotting out because of leaks and things. You go in and identify those problems and fix them for me? Is that how it works?
Primarily, we do for folks earning 80% and below the area median income. So for a family of four, that's about $52,000 per year, per household. We do that through a federal program, with federal program dollars, community development block grant dollars.
How do you identify these people?
People know of our programs. They're advertised.
They call you.
They called us. They call the city of Charlotte. But what I want to go back to, Mike, we've thrown around a lot of terms. We've talked about affordable housing. We've talked about crappy housing. I want to be clear. What the city's programs are and what the city council advocates for is quality affordable housing. We do that primarily through, number one, preserving through our Safe Home Program. We do that through leveraging housing trust fund dollars, which are those voter-approved dollars that people go to the polls and vote for every 2 years. We do that by leveraging those with federal low-income housing tax credits. So we advocate and try to provide quality affordable housing. When people think about affordable housing, they think about that crappy housing. But I would argue to you, what's being built today is equal or better than market rate housing. So affordable housing, it's an equation. We all need affordable housing. No one should be paying more than 30% of their annual income for their housing.
We have two Pamelas at the table here. That's Pamela Weidman from the city of Charlotte. Also with us is Pam Kelly, a reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And your article about Biddleville, Pam, points out that managing gentrification is best done before a neighborhood becomes popular, often with a city or nonprofit buying properties to preserve affordable housing before investors drive up prices. Has that happened here? Is it happening in Biddleville?
It has happened some, but not nearly enough. And some of the people I talk to feel that there are neighborhoods that the time has passed, Biddleville being one.
Meaning what?
The land is too expensive. Okay. I mean, you need nonprofits and government agencies need to buy up the land while it's still affordable. And that was probably before the recession. And people who work in
but nobody saw that recession coming, so there was no need to act.
Well,
right?
I mean, interestingly, there were investors buying up properties even before the recession in a lot of these neighborhoods. So some people feel that for some neighborhoods, Cherry, for instance, a lot of it it's too late. And I would say Biddleville as well.
And yet I understand the city has done this in Cherry. Is that correct? And yet when you drive through Cherry today, if you drive through Cherry 2 years ago and you drove through today, you would be astounded at the difference.
That's correct, Mike. You would be astounded at the difference. You see the original housing stock, the flavor of the original housing stock, and you see some of what's being built there today. Mm-hmm. The two are very different. But back to the point about the city getting in earlier to preserve or assist in constructing new affordable housing, that was done in Cherry. Cherry Gardens, 42 units of senior housing. Just last night, the city council approved housing trust fund dollars for another Baxter Street development that will, if awarded the low-income housing tax credits from the federal government through the state, there will be 30 additional units of affordable housing. Not nearly enough, but that is, the city has taken some steps to do that. Also in Brightwalk, that's probably the best example of where the city, in partnership with the Charlotte Housing Partnership, the affordable developments in Brightwalk led. Those developments signaled to the market that something new was coming. There was some new investment along that Statesville Road corridor.
This is really walking a tightrope because many of these houses were inexpensive when they were built. They have come really, by all measures, to the end of their useful life cycle. And there comes a point when do you want to put more money into something that really needs to be rebuilt? Or do you want to just take it down and rebuild it? And yet people live there. It's their home. They don't want to leave. Perhaps they can't afford to leave. And yet everything around them is changing. How do you walk that tightrope?
Well, I don't think a lot of those houses have reached the end of their life cycle. They're probably more sturdily built than anything built today, even expensive housing built today. Older buildings are a huge resource they're a huge availability resource because they're already built, and they're green because they're already built. I think what happens in neighborhoods like Cherry is that you've got two different concerns going on. One is the displacement and the affordable housing concern, and the city's trying to ensure that more affordable housing gets built. The other concern is the fabric and the flavor of the neighborhood. And Cherry's got an amazingly rich history. I mean, it's African-American neighborhood, always been African-American, predated Myers Park. People grew up there, and it was like their community. We did some oral histories, and some of the Cherry folks were talking about they would have to cross Little Sugar Creek in order to feel safe. When they were in Brooklyn, they'd get beat up by the Brooklyn guys. and they go to Cherry, that was home, they were safe. So there's this wonderful history, and that is kind of getting wiped away because the neighborhood's changing so much.
Well, that's one of the undercurrents of concern here, is it not? You just mentioned Brooklyn. Newcomers to Charlotte have no idea what you're talking about. It's First Ward. It's Second Ward, excuse me. It is where the hotel at McDowell is. It's where the Aquatic Center is. It's where McDowell Park is. It's everything from Trade Street to McDowell and from what? Or actually Stonewall. And then everything from what? McDowell to Tryon. So it's that whole area. It was Brooklyn. It was an African-American neighborhood. And as part of urban renewal, it was completely wiped off the map. And those people had to move to other areas, which are now becoming gentrified. And we don't want to repeat that. That is the goal, correct?
And you know, some of the comments I got on my story, because I went into the history and it tried to explain why there could be bad feelings. And I talked about Brooklyn, and some of the comments were like, well, people need to get over it. And I would just argue that I think a lot of people in Charlotte don't know what it is. They don't know what happened.
Yeah. This was a thriving city within a city.
Yeah.
And it churches, had some, businesses, right. Homes. And it just was completely taken
right.
away.
And there was supposed to be new housing built for people displaced by urban renewal, and there was none built. I think the real estate community fought against that because you don't want to have too much supply.
When Pam just said people told her that people just ought to get over it, you went, Christopher. You've heard this before.
Because that's the common theme that we hear a lot when we talk about gentrification. And again, I said it earlier, we've gotten it wrong so many times, and it's becoming the norm. And one of the key things around displacement factor is that the people that are displaced, they're never able to come back to these communities and be a part of the economical growth of the area unless they're renting, and most of them can't afford the rents. So therefore, it becomes that paradigm again.
Jerry emails, do renters have a right to remain in place? Isn't gentrification just a matter of willing sellers and buyers? So if you're the owner of the house or the apartment building and somebody offers you, and it's worth $100,000, and somebody offers you $250,000 just to get out of it, just to get you out of it so they can put their $500,000 house up, it's a transaction, right? So do renters have any rights at all?
No.
They do not.
They don't.
They do not.
And that's here where a lot of the issues lie. We talk about the displacement factor. The rent, as the areas increase in values, the renters are the ones, the first ones to really get pushed because they're seeing an increase in rent. And they'll normally stay around for a while. But after a certain point, the rent becomes so high, they've got to move.
As president of the Lockwood neighborhood, how concerned are you about this move toward gentrification? Because it's beginning to affect your neighborhood, too, I think. Is this a major concern for you and for residents who live there who are looking around saying, I've got no place else to go?
Everybody knows me, knows I'm focused on the community and focused in Lockwood and working to try and do the right thing and get it right. Lockwood in the early 90s was on the tip of the iceberg. So, yes, it's been a major issue for us, and we've seen the wave coming, and now we're at the point where the tidal wave has already hit. Lockwood's done a great job of partnering with the city and other organizations to try and help offset some of the things that we're seeing. And we've done a great job. And now if you drive through Lockwood, it's not the area, the perception that was before is not the perception now. And people that are moving in are seeing that. And so, yes, we're at that cuff now where people are realizing Lockwood does exist. It's a great place to raise a family and be a part of. And now we're actually running into those issues where people want to move there more.
That's Christopher Dennis, who's the president of the Lockwood neighborhood, among other things. And we're also here with Pamela Wideman from the city, Mary Newsom from the UNC Charlotte Urban Institute, and Pam Kelly, reporter for the Charlotte Observer. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Truliant Federal Credit Union, a member-owned, not-for-profit community credit union, 12 Charlotte area locations, including Ballantyne, Steel Creek, and Park Road. Truliant, life improved. Details at truliant.org. And Northeastern University Charlotte campus hosting an open house on Saturday for those interested in graduate degrees and certificate programs. Details at northeastern.edu/charlotte-open-house. President Obama has has approved the deployment of an additional 250 special operations forces to Syria to advise and assist in the fight against ISIS. So on the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes, they'll talk about the status of the conflict and new efforts to undermine the Islamic State's power in the region and its influence beyond. That's coming up at 10 this morning. If you'd like to join our conversation, now is your time at charlottetalks@wfae.org, or you can get to us through Facebook or Twitter. We're coming right back.
Joe Klosik, owner of the Corkscrew Wine Shop, a WFAE underwriter.
You have the diversity in your programming and the diversity of the folks that listen. And those folks that listen come to our shop. When we chose to underwrite with WFAE, that was part of our identity, part of our brand. I would say it was one of the best decisions we ever made.
Find out more. Email underwriting@wfae.org for details.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about gentrification. When we talk about this, is there more concern today or less concern today about the racial aspect of this? Because urban renewal in the 60s pushed a lot of black people out of neighborhoods they'd lived in their entire lives. Now gentrification is taking over as we have this thrust of people who want to move and live close to the inner core of a city. Is it more of an economic issue now than a racial issue? Or is the racial component still part of this? Because that's where people live.
I'm going to jump in as a white person, so the African-American folks can correct me later. But I think that one of the legacies of urban renewal in Brooklyn is this sort of undercurrent of anger and resentment. And so if you're being pushed out now through economic forces, you still remember being pushed out, or maybe your parents or your mm-hmm. family being pushed out. So you've got this undercurrent of resentment that you then bring to bear on what's happening today. So I don't think you can really divorce the economic from the racial.
I would agree with that, Mike. I mean, again, having attended neighborhood meetings in Cherry, we see the racial issue still play out.
Sure.
And I definitely say that racialism is the undertone that's there, because I think that minorities in these areas feel that they're more involved and not included, meaning they're talked at but not talked to try and figure out how do we increase our involvement and engagement to be a part and included in this economical shift.
But when they come to the meetings, poor people generally, I've read this yesterday, I think somebody at this table said this today, poor people don't come to these meetings, and that's where the decisions allegedly are made as a result of these meetings. So when they come, are they listened to? Do they participate?
I will say in Lockwood, we've had that challenge of getting everyone, and that's one of the things that as community leaders we have to focus on, getting everyone to the table, and not just the homeowner but also the renter and also transit population, because our community, that was a major plague for our community. But we try to focus on getting everyone involved. And when they do attend, I want to correct that and say that they do attend the meetings. They don't come as frequent as they should, and we have to encourage them. But getting the education to everyone is important. And the ones that do attend are very concerned, because they know and they see the issues. But the question becomes, what can I do about it? And that's where you get the hands thrown up and they back away from the table.
What can they do? Are there strategies that people can use to do something about this?
There are, Mike. But let me go back and say that, you know, in many cases, it's an assumption that poor people don't come to the meeting.
Okay.
And it's assumption about how you define poor. I would say in cases where poor people don't come to the meeting, we need to look at that. Why aren't they coming to the meetings? Sometimes poor renters don't feel welcome. They feel like these meetings are for homeowners only. And so as a neighborhood, one of the things we do at the city is we ask that people make the meetings open and inclusive and encourage everybody to come, whether if you're renting or homeownership. So make them inclusive. But oftentimes when people don't come to the meetings, they're working two and three jobs. They if a meeting is at 6 o'clock, they're still on their job. They can't get there. So we need to be
really
sensitive.
You know, the city has a habit of holding meetings at 5 and 5:30. And I've often wondered why, when they must know that all city workers are still working, why wouldn't I be? Why don't you hold them at 7 or 7:30 or 8?
Well, I would say to you that our city council, they meet 6:30 to 7. They have to.
That's their job.
That's their job, right? They have a citizens forum at 6:30. You can sign up. You can plan to be there.
But that's early for a lot of people.
Some people it is. And so you have to manage that. Neighborhood meetings, though, are generally at 7 o'clock or so. So with the hopes that people have gotten off work, that they can be there.
That disturbs me. You have to manage that. We're citizens. You're working for us. So why aren't you putting meetings at convenient times so that people who do work for a living and sometimes are working three jobs can come to these meetings? Why does it have to be at your convenience? Why do I have to manage it?
Well, it's hard to figure out when is that appropriate time. If we did a 10 o'clock.
Have them several. You have your 5:30 meeting, or you have a 7 o'clock meeting or an 8 o'clock meeting later on the same thing?
Well, what I will suggest to you is that we have citizens forum several times per month. So it's not like if you miss it one month.
What time are they?
They're at 6:30. There are several opportunities.
You're making my point.
Somebody who used to work the night shift, it doesn't matter if it's 6:30 or 5 o'clock or 3 o'clock, you're kind of out of luck.
But there are other forums, right? And Chris can attest to this. You can always call up to express your concerns. You can email to express your concern. Many of the city departments have Facebook pages, Twitter accounts. So there are ways to get your voice heard.
Okay.
One point I want to stress out, I think to your point, Pam, is that we can do a better job of working together and getting the community leaders, the neighborhood presidents engaged to make sure that communication happens. Because if we can bring a lot of this information to the neighborhood association meeting, we can get that stuff disseminated. But here's the issue. We talked about, I call it survival mode. We know that people in the community, the low-income folks we're talking about, most of them are, like we said, in survival mode, meaning they're trying to figure out how can I feed my family,
right,
not save a community.
Right. And to add to that, you know, back to how you get your voice heard in the city, I'm very sensitive to that. And I will say that we have very active district city council representatives and at-large representatives. So people, if you're working, you can reach out to your city council member. We have a very active, I would frame it, a grassroots mayor. She's always interested in hearing from people. So people can call 311. People can call their city council representatives. So there are ways to get your voice heard outside of the meetings that are often held when people are working.
Helms on Twitter writes, let's talk about who holds the development power, decision-making, and money. City planners are not neighborhood dwellers. Would that be true?
Many of our city planners live in neighborhoods. I mean, they live somewhere.
I'm going to beg to differ. I don't think that a lot of developers that are working to develop in these areas, and that's one of my pet peeves, is that I believe that if you're going to work on development or invest in areas, you should try and live in those areas. And I beg to differ. That doesn't happen a lot.
Liz emails, a few years ago, I was president of a small neighborhood called Villa Heights. When bringing up affordable housing options within our neighborhood committee meetings, most of the new residents had no desire to accommodate this, as it would affect their home values negatively. Gentrification has a tendency to strip neighborhoods of their sense of community and becomes a haven for self-service and benefit. Let's be honest about that. That's probably true. If you've just plunked down $800,000 for a house, you want to protect your property value, don't you?
Yeah, I've talked to a police lieutenant who has been in Biddleville for decades and has told me about how the calls have changed. You know, it used to be, you know, heroin overdoses, shootings, and now people are complaining that people have parked the wrong way on the street, or, you know, there's a dog off a leash, or which is good, but it shows your point about
expectations and sensibilities change.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't always mesh with the people who have been there for the longest time.
Mike, I would just add, though, well-built and well-managed quality affordable housing does not negatively impact one's property value.
Okay. One of the things that does happen, and I think, Pam, you point out in your story about Biddleville that after the recession, while Charlotte property values overall rose 11%, those in Biddleville rose 34%. Wow.
Yeah,
you've made a profit.
I was surprised.
If you bought a house, you made a profit very quickly. But that also impacts every time there's a tax assessment. That's going to impact your tax bill. Are there Is there anything in place in the survey, tax abatement, is there any tax abatement in place in the city to help people who are victims of that, who didn't do anything? They didn't move. They've always been there. And suddenly, because everybody around them has $800,000 houses, the property values have gone up. Therefore, the taxes have gone up. Can you protect those people?
So, Mike, there's a tool called the Homestead Exemption Act that's managed by the county tax assessor's office, and primarily it serves the very low income. I can't quote the numbers, but it serves the very low income. As far as tax abatement, that's illegal, as I understand it, in North Carolina.
It's illegal.
We would need enabling legislation to have a tax abatement program. Some cities do. Some states do. We do not in Charlotte, North Carolina.
But that's what drives out the homeowners, people who want to sell, they sell. But
predominantly the seniors. It affects predominantly the seniors at that level because they're the ones that are currently on the set incomes. And I think that legislation should look at the Homestead Act because there's an issue when it comes to the income cap that is restricted on that. And that if a senior has worked or has a pension coming in, even on the set incomes, they still don't meet those guidelines and they can't benefit.
Well, it certainly affects seniors because, as you say, they're on this fixed income. But I don't know very many people who've gotten raises in the last 8, 9, 10 years. So they too are on a fixed income.
Sure.
It's not like they can go to the boss and say, I need 30% more because my tax bill went up. This affects everybody.
Right. And, Mike, all of that's true. I agree with Chris. I agree with you. Not very many people have gotten raises. And so, again, you asked me a few minutes ago, what are some of the strategies, mm-hmm. right? And so that makes the point for affordable housing. Gentrification actually makes the point for quality, well-built, affordable housing.
Well, you were on this program not too long ago, and we talked a little about this and the fact that the city has in place or had in, I guess they still do, have in place incentives for developers to include affordable housing in new projects that they are putting up. And I think only one developer has taken you up on this in the last several years. Is that correct?
So what we have is what's called a voluntary mixed income density bonus program. No one has taken us up on that. But what has happened since I was here on the show several months ago, we've had several developers agree to incorporate some affordable housing through the rezoning process in some new developments. You also asked me about what are strategies making the city of Charlotte won't do this alone. We can't do it alone. And so it's a community effort. And so one of the strategies is to partner with the philanthropic landowners to create mixed income housing. The faith institutions, the Catholic diocese, they've done a good job of not trying, but they have successfully built affordable housing, making publicly owned land available for affordable housing. I'm not just talking about city-owned land. I'm talking about county-owned land and school board-owned land.
Mary.
There's a variety of ways that cities try to keep property values from going up too much too fast. One of them is height limits, especially in an intense area like uptown or the areas near uptown. Charlotte's height limits are fairly high. I think in downtown or uptown, you can build as high as the FAA will allow you.
Mm-hmm.
So, in effect, there's no height limit. In the transit areas, the height limit is maybe 10 or 12 stories. I can't remember. And ditto for another zoning called MUD. I'm going to try to stay out of these zoning weeds here. But I did have a developer tell me that in his opinion, one reason people weren't opting for the voluntary affordable housing, you get a density bonus, is that the zoning that you can get already allows you to build as much as the market is going to bear. So being told, hey, you can build even more units doesn't help you.
There is probably an unanticipated and unintended silver cloud or silver lining to this cloud that we've been talking about, and that deals with Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools who are struggling with pupil assignment and an effort to re-diversify a school system that has become essentially resegregated, this time mostly by economics. And Pam, you point out very early in your recent article about white people moving into Biddleville that this new diversity could solve a problem for the system. And this is happening in other neighborhoods. So could this be the solution that CMS is looking for?
You know, it could. We did busing so many years ago because our neighborhoods were segregated. So if we integrate our neighborhoods, it solves the problem. And in Biddleville, it's interesting. There are a number of young families with babies, they're pregnant, preschool age kids, and they're talking about trying to do something to make their neighborhood school, Bruns Academy, which I think is very high poverty at this point and not doing very well, trying to make it better. And everybody talks about the template of Shamrock Gardens, which has been a success. So if folks in Biddleville and Seversville and Wesley Heights got together and they sent their kids to Bruns Academy, now they have a lot of different choices, so they don't have to. They could go to charter, private schools. You know, that school could be turned around.
Wow. You say, Christopher, I want to call you Richard.
You're fine.
You say that we have to change how we engage low-income communities in these discussions. What does that mean?
It means two things. One, I think, is first, I had a statement with Lockwood a long time ago, the hood is state of mind, the community is a way of life. We've got to stop calling these areas the hood. If we want to change the perception of these communities, we
didn't that come from the African American community itself?
Yes. Okay. And we've got to what we call our communities is how we're going to treat our communities. And the key thing is community is a way of life is to me that means that we have to figure out ways to improve for everyone and not just an individual. And getting it right for me means one really key thing is that's education. We've got to figure out how to educate the homeowners that are in these areas on what it means to be gentrified so they can figure out how to play the game and get involved and not be left out. And I think that's what causes a lot of the strife when people feel they're left out and they're not included. And I know through working through partnerships that's being done, but we need to do a better job of it. And we got to figure out how we're communicating to these communities, because putting it in a newspaper or putting it on a billboard doesn't really help. We've got to get boots on the ground in the community and say, here's how gentrification works. Here's how you can play a part of it. Here's how you can get engaged. And I know as a community leader, we try to be the front line for that. But again, we're just volunteers with the passion of wanting to drive and change communities. And it's hard. And we need bigger boots on the ground to help make that happen. But I will say, on the benefit of the city, they've done a great job in getting engaged and helping provide that, because a lot of our community, neighborhood, and business services leaders, they are engaged with us, but we need more. We need everyone.
And you get the last word. Christopher Dennis, president of the Lockwood Neighborhood. Mary Newsom, associate director of urban and regional affairs for UNC Charlotte's Urban Institute. Pamela Weidman, deputy director of neighborhood and business services for the city of Charlotte, and the person responsible for the catalyst for all of this discussion today, Pam Kelly, a reporter for the Charlotte Observer. You can read her article about Biddleville on charlotteobserver.com. Thank you all for being here.